Let's stand for prayer. And now, our Heavenly Father, we present ourselves before you. We are needy, and we want to open our hearts and learn a few things from you. Father, you have shown us that story is a good way to do that, and we want to tell the story accurately, and we want to understand the lessons from these stories. And Father, we realize we're not talking about fictional stories, but things that have actually happened. And so we want to take lessons from these things. So Father, we ask your presence here to direct what is said and what is understood, that your kingdom might be advanced. So please be with us just now. We pray in Jesus' name of thanksgiving. Amen. Be seated. A few things as leftovers from this morning. First of all, last night I told you about the Prussian Mennonites and the how they became Nazis. Well, Mennonite Quarterly Review in October 2010 published an article entitled "Mennonites and the Holocaust: From Collaboration to Perpetuation" by Gerhard Rempel. Well, some kind brother here was getting an email from me from my wife, and I don't know where he found this, but he found the same article and he printed it out. I have a copy in MQR, but if first of all, whichever brother this was, it's yours. Who was kind enough to do this? Jonathan, who's Jonathan? Okay, so it's his, but if he wants to share it with somebody, that's wonderful. It's many pages, from 507 through 549. So we're talking about over 40 pages of text here. And this man, Gerhard Rempel, he's specializing in the research and uncovering the actual stories of that time period. So thank you, Jonathan, for taking care of that. There may be, there's articles further coming out in the future which will tell more of this story. I was reminded in dinner discussion that I should have said something else this morning, so I think I'll take time to say it right now. would there be a 7-year-old boy in the audience? 7 years old. Raise your hand if you're 7. Would you come up here? Are you brave? Grit. Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that's 17? I'm a young man who's 17. You are. Okay. Are you brave? Okay. Why don't you stand right there? Okay. Is there a young man in the audience who's 27? 27. Thank you. He must be brave. He's just walking up here. Okay, you stand over there. Okay, this morning I was talking about how faith is passed on, and I should have said this. And I say this to parents just for you to understand. There are things going on in young people's hearts that we just have to understand as parents. Okay, this young man believes that his father is the biggest and the best. He just really appreciates his father, looks up to him, and dreams of the day he can be just like him. Okay, you don't have to agree with me. I just know boys this age. Okay, that's the way they are. Okay, when you turn 17, now don't tell me your story, but I just know that 17-year-olds have lots of questions about their dad. Somehow, dad is not as smart as I thought he was. Dad is mean. Dad is unreasonable. Dad is not with it. He's old-fashioned. Other people let their children do things, but my dad. Okay, I'm talking generalities. I'm not blaming the Judean. Okay, I just want you to understand that that's what 17-year-old boys think. They're in their question stage. And it's okay. It's okay, Dan, that your son is like this. Just don't get upset with him. Don't ever say to him, well, you when you were seven, you didn't think that way. What's wrong with you now? Just don't say that. Okay? He just has to go through that. Okay? But it's okay. Okay, but whenever he turns 27, it's like, it's amazing how much Dad knows. I don't know where he learned it all so fast. Now, the knowledge you have of your dad at 27 and the knowledge he has of his dad of 7 is probably two different things. Yours is more of a realism. His was idealism. Okay? Thank you. You're a brave man. The Russian Mennonite story is a long story, and I cannot tell you everything about the story. If we could have the lights off. We started out in Holland. I talked to you some about what happened here, but I'm going to skip over the part of the story as to why the people moved from here to here. I'm going to jump down to this part of the story. And I'm not going to even tell you the story of them coming across to America. So I want you to be well aware that I'm not telling you all the story. If you want to read more, there are certain books. Come to me and I will help you find some resources for the rest of the story. But I do want you to take notice while we're thinking here that Prussia is the center here is the Vistula Delta, and that's on the Baltic Sea over here, right up against the Baltic Sea. To go to Ukraine is not that far, but it's quite a distance back in those days before they had trucks and cars. It took months to travel from here to here. You'll notice this is the Black Sea. This is the Crimean Peninsula. Okay, when they came here, the very first place they settled with Tsarina Catherine the Great's invitation was at Cortitsa. 1789 is the founding date for Cortitsa. Folks, that is after the American Declaration of Independence of 1776. So we could say that they started in Cortitsa about the time that our country was founded, time-wise. Afterwards, the second one at Malashna was 1803. That's only just a little over 200 years ago that they started in Malashna. Now, after that, there were two separate movements. This shows one line, but there was a movement further east and north at Tract in 1853, and another one a few years later in 1861 at Samara. But you notice they all come from Prussia. These new settlements up in here originated here. Now you'll have to compare that with this. This shows a number of daughter colonies. Here's the original Cortitsa. Here's the Malashna. But these are daughter colonies around them. Some of these people moved different places, and I'm going to tell you about, at least refer to this one, Klaus Epp, who moved over to Turkmenistan. Okay, so first of all, they came from Prussia to here, and then they went from here to other parts. You notice that one of these places they went is into Siberia. Here's the Black Sea, here's the Caspian Sea. The center of their settlements were between the two or near the two, but they did reach up into Siberia. Now, this is a closer look. This is with the Cortitsa and Malashna colonies. Here is Cortiza. This is the first one they came to, 1789. Here is the second one at Malashna, 1803. But if my history serves me straight, this is the first daughter colony from Cortiza. This is Bergthal. This colony figures later into the story in coming to America. Most of this colony moved in whole. I don't think everybody did. Most everybody came to Canada from this. This colony right here, the first inland colony, it's another daughter colony for Cortiza. If you ever bump into old colony Mennonites, this is where they come from, first inland. And the reason they're called old colony is because Cortiza was the old colony, or the first colony that was settled from Prussia. And they still carry that old colony name to this day. You'll also notice right here is Hutterthal. Johann Cornies, which is going to be coming into the story today, helped these people who were further away in Russia come and settle near the Malashna colony. These people did not live as Hutterites here. They lived in an open colony and community like the Mennonites did. But whenever they moved to Canada, and in these people decided that they're going to go to the United States instead of Canada, and they settled in South Dakota. And all these people came, every one of them. So there were no Hutterite descendants left in Russia. When they came to South Dakota, then they picked up the Hutterite colony way of living, but not all of them. There is what they call the prairie light, which when they came to South Dakota, continued to live as they did in Russia, just as a group of people, a colony, without a Bruderhof. So these people had two ways once they came over to the United States. This is Berdyansk. This was a place where they shipped their wheat around the world. These are agricultural communities. A man by the name of Cornelius Jansen, who figures large into the story I will not tell you today, was a broker, a grain broker, and he introduced threshing machines to these colonies that greatly increased their ability to produce wheat. And he sold wheat as a broker around the world, especially to England. He learned English, and God used him in amazing ways in the movement of a transmigration of these people to America. I'm not going to tell that story today. Just for human interest, this is, if you ever hear the Krimmer brethren, here's where they were, Crimea. They get Krimmer from Crimea. This is the Black Sea here. I guess I better just leave this one up here. All right, now I'll take some lights. Now, when Catherine the Great made this invitation to these people to come to Ukraine, it's because Russia had just fought a war with people. It's like American Indians, and the land was empty, and they wanted the empty steppes of Russia filled and farmed. And she knew about these people because she was from Prussia. And so she invited these industrious people to come. It was like a godsend because they were running out of land in Prussia, and they just felt like this is an answer to prayer. So listen, I'm going to share with you now the opportunity she gave to these people. And this is in writing. Number one, absolute freedom of religion. Number two, 70 hectares of free land, which it turns out to be about 175 acres of free land for every household. Number three, freedom to engage in business. Number four, freedom to brew beer and distill brandy. Number five, a prohibition against non-Mennonite cafes and inns operating on Mennonite land. Number six, prohibition against selling brandy without their permission. Number seven, 10 years exemption from taxes. Number eight, a subsidy to cover traveling costs to get from Prussia down there. Number nine, the delivery of a supply of lumber for building houses. Number 10, a loan of 500 rubles for families that needed starting capital. 11, exemption from military service. And number 12, they did not need to pay compensation for the maintenance of roads and bridges and other forms of servitude. The Mennonites received more than any other group. She knew these were good people, and she wanted them pretty badly. And she judged correctly. They made the land fruitful and became an example to other immigrant groups. Okay, so that is what she's offering. What did she expect in return? The Mennonites agreed not to proselytize among the Orthodox state church. No evangelism. Number two, anyone who left the group left the privileges granted to the group. In other words, if you left, you suffered. Number three, just like in Prussia, children of mixed marriages could not retain Mennonite privileges. And number four, the 175-acre farms could not be subdivided by inheritance, but must remain intact. And number five, land titles could not be sold without the consent of the village. And the Mennonites said, okay, deal made. And they moved. Neither Danzig nor the Prussian authorities were anxious to lose these enterprising Mennonites. And thus, they denied passports to any Mennonite who owned property. Did you get that? The Prussians valued these people, even though they barely tolerated them. They still wanted them. It's like a love-hate relationship. When it came time to leave, they said, okay, if you have property, you can't leave. Only the poor people received passports. And so, the situation was dire back in Prussia. So that when, by 1788, the year before Cortese was founded right here, 228 poor families had left, mostly from the Flemish branch of the church. Remember I talked about the Friesians and Flemish? Mostly Flemish. But there was no preacher in the group. Can you imagine 228 families with no leader? What do you do? How do you do that? Preachers were usually well-to-do. And no one suitable for leadership could be found. Thus, the first group who came here was leaderless and shepherdless. That meant no communions, no baptisms, and no weddings. And we sit here and we shake our heads and I say, how could that be? I'm telling you the story the way it was. They'll have to answer that question. Secondly, on the way down here, before they ever got here, they discovered that they would not be permitted to settle where they had been promised land. And the reason was the war was still too close. And they would need to settle upriver from their promised land. And that land was less desirable. And so when they got there, the weary settlers were disappointed with their bare, hilly land. There was no sign of a living thing anywhere. Some settlers that had just come from Prussia were so disappointed that they refused to unpack their belongings, hoping that the Russian government would relent and provide more promising land. Well, the government provided building materials were slow in coming. And sometimes they didn't come. On the way, somebody stole the lumber. So they did the best they could. They created sod shanties with thatched roofs. And there's other stories there. But in spite of the terrible beginnings here, emigration continued. From 1793 to 1797, 118 more families moved. But this time, it was mostly Friesians, not Flemish. So that by 1824, there were 400 families that had settled right here in Cortiza. They had 18 villages to host those 400 families. Now, I didn't bring it overhead to show the village system, but what they did is they had a road down through, and they had houses, and their houses had barns attached to them. How many of you have ever seen a house-barn combination? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Is that done? There's nobody does that around here, is there? Are there really? A house-barn combinations? Okay, good. Then you know what we're talking about. Okay, so along the street, on both sides of the street, were all these house-barn combinations, but their farms, a little bit of land was with them, but they also had acreage further away. They wanted to live in a compact unit, not necessarily on their farms. Here, everybody lives on their farms and farms the land around them. That's not the way these colonies were. Okay. But then Catherine the Great died in 1796. But increasing restrictions in Prussia meant that there still needs to be more Mennonites leaving for Russia. And so, in 1803, they headed for the second place, right here, Malashna. The first left in 1803 as a 162 family group. But this time, most of the people who came to Malashna were well-to-do farmers. They needed to pay a 10% emigration tax to leave their homeland. Russia had set aside 300,000 acres of fertile, treeless land in South Russia along the Malashna River. And every year after that saw wagon trains after wagon train headed to South Russia from Danzig or from Prussia. And so by 1820, 600 families had moved. And in the next 20 years, 400 more families would move. And so by 1846, there were 10,000 people in 46 villages. The Malashna settlers were better farmers. They had more money to start with and started off with greater capital resources. And they did not suffer the economic hardships as the people did at Cortiza. And secondly, these people brought ministers and leaders with them. But the Malashna settlement was nearer to the frontier than Cortiza and suffered at the hands of the nomadic Tatars. They're like we would call American Indians. There were still some of them around. The Tatars had been pushed off their land to make room for these Mennonites. Sounds like America, doesn't it? And they often raided the settlements, driving off horses and cattle. Okay, in addition to those two settlements, as I shared with you before, we have later on, and I'm not going to go there, these other settlements at Tract and Samara. Okay, these are close by, but they're not as close as the originals right down here. They were really in the same area. These two were different locations. They were out of the territory. Okay, so the total number of immigrants from West Prussia and elsewhere by 1870. Now, this is about the same time that Mennonites started coming to Canada and the U.S. The total number of immigrants from West Prussia was estimated at 9,000. By that date, the original numbers had multiplied to 45,000. By 1914, that number had increased to 100,000, occupied nearly 3 million acres, an area three times the size of Rhode Island. So we're talking about significant. This is significant to the Russian government. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. And we have all these people who went down there, and they turned this barren, empty land into this breadbasket. And were feeding a large number of people. They did exactly what Catherine the Great hoped they would do. In these village system, each village had between 15 to 30 families. Each house, barn, stable, and shop were all under one roof, with the gable end facing the street. The front yard became a flower garden, and the rear of the place was a fruit orchard and a truck patch. Out away from the village lay the pasture land and the farmland. And they would have herders who would take the cows. They had a separate place for pasture. And a boy, a young man, would take the cows out for pasture each day. Johann Kornes from the Molochna settlement became a successful big-scale farmer. Let me show you his picture. This is just a drawing of him. I don't think he actually looked like this. I'd really like to see a photograph of him. He became known far and near as an agricultural expert. Government officials, including Tsar Alexander I and II, came to visit his farm. By the time he died, he held 25,000 acres, a flock of 8,000 merino sheep, 400 horses, and a large herd of thoroughbred cattle. And that was, I'm 63, I think he died when he was 59. Both Cortica and Molochna experienced steady economic growth. In time, the treeless steppes were converted into flourishing fields, orchards and pastures, endless wheat fields, and beautiful private estates. The Russian Mennonites became wealthy far beyond the native Russian people. Let me show you some pictures. As Mennonites became more settled and prosperous, they imported features from Europe, such as the ornate stylings on the Johann Peters residence in New Hauptstadt, Russia. That's one of the daughter colonies. Many successful Mennonites amassed large estates outside the Mennonite colonies. This is Jacob Goosen's estate at Wintergruen, South Russia, 1900. See the fine horses, carriage?
And servants?
Okay, let's just talk about this. Whenever many of these people wanted to move to Canada, Russia sent a general out to talk to them and tell them to stay. And he told them. He says, here in Russia, you have servants to do your work. If you go to America, you have to work hard all by yourself. Why do you want to go work when you can stay here and have servants do your work? This is the way the Russian Mennonites operated, with servants. Notice the finery. That's all distant. Here's a fine couple. In the original, had a caption knife. He was a Mennonite brethren minister. I can remember that part. But eventually, the land provided to the Mennonites in South Russia got full. A landless group of young families developed, just like it had back in Prussia. And they had no choice except to work as farm laborers or work at factories for wages. By 1870, which is about the time they started coming to America, at least two-thirds of all the heads of families in both Cortica and Molochna were landless once again. They were given a small patch of land of which to build a house and make out the best they could. And they had these daughter colonies that sprang up, such as Bergthal. But it still didn't solve the whole problem. The more religiously conscientious sometimes went to these daughter settlements. But a problem developed because only landowners had a voice in the local village assembly where all the land policies and other policies were made. The ministers were chosen because they were wealthy. The landless had no voice. As they promised, the Russian government allowed the Mennonite villages to govern themselves. And so the Mennonites operated a virtual commonwealth, a Mennonite commonwealth inside Russia. The Mennonites controlled their own schools, their roads, they provided for the poor, they established fire departments, they apportioned arable farm lots, and whatever needed to be done to make a settlement work, they did. At the head of each village was a magistrate called a Schultz, elected by the landowners. The Schultz was responsible for petty misdemeanors. A town meeting composed of landowners made all the local regulations. Now, I'm hoping there are alarm bells going off in your mind with this. But someone tell me, what's the alarm bells going off in your mind by this? Pardon? They made their own state. So there's no separation of church and state. But they did it on their own. Instead of holding to this principle of separation of church and state strictly, when they had the chance to make their own state, they created it. So, when you have a state, somebody has to punish offenders. Who's going to do that? A Mennonite is going to have to punish a Mennonite. Is that okay? For a Mennonite to put another Mennonite in jail? Or for one Mennonite to whip another Mennonite? Is that okay? There's a problem. Okay. In accordance with the social and religious culture of the times, the Mennonites lived and worked in isolation from their Russian neighbors. This commonwealth that they operated, everybody within their colonies spoke their language, Plattdeutsch. And they lived and worked among themselves. They hired local Russians to be servants to come in and do their work. But they lived in isolation among themselves, so much so that many Mennonites were not even able to speak Russian. Their villages did not include native Russians. There might have been a village down the road that was native Russian. But the native Russians were like, they were considered inferior. And you kept those at arm's length. They could work for us, but they may not be members of our church. Now, the Mennonites were not the only people operating like this. There were many other Germans there, German Lutherans and German Catholics, who also emigrated from Germany with them and operated much the same way. So this is not just a Mennonite issue. The Mennonites were only a small fraction, about one-tenth of the German people who emigrated to Russia. Eventually, these German islands in Russia came to haunt the Mennonites, even though they were legal Russian citizens. Harry Lowen wrote, quote, "The majority of the Russian Mennonites around 1870 were patriotic and loyal to the Tsar, but they did not identify with the Russian people and did not accommodate themselves to the culture." Let me pause to say, in Russia, they had the concept of being a subject to a lord. In America, America was founded in terms of citizenship. There is no such thing as subjects. And so when these emissaries from Russia came over to check out the land for moving, they went to visit President Grant and ask if he would grant them freedom. And President Grant says, "I can't do that. I mean, I don't have that power." The Russians had no concept of citizenship because they always had worked as a subject-lord relationship. Now, President Grant did tell them, in the recent war, in the Civil War, your people did not actually end up having to fight. So you probably won't have to fight, but I can't guarantee it. I mean, that has to be made by law. That's just a little interesting sidelight. Okay, now, if I could go back over a few things about Cortice and their beginnings.
Those original pioneering families experienced very many difficulties. The emigrants that came were, in the truest sense, abandoned, poor in body and soul. And by 1796, when Catherine the Great died, and more people had come, it was still kind of wobbly, I guess you could say, but it was getting off the ground. And like I said, the Malachian economy got off to a much better start. But in 1840, the Russian government settlement projects came to an end. Further settlement projects would need to be self-supporting. From here on, the government is not going to subsidize you, any of you Germans who come from Prussia. In 1848, the Prussians ended the privilege of exemption from military service based on religious confession. And so when Prussia made that rule in 1848, that sent another wave of Mennonites down to Russia. This time, the Mennonites asked the Russian government for permission to emigrate to Russia, a new location, and that's the the Russian government says, okay, we'll let 100 families come. Well, the first 20 through two went to Amtrak. I showed you that on the map earlier. And these people were led by a man by the name of Klaus Epp. He left Prussia in 1853. Other well-to-do families soon followed, until by 1858, there were 1,000 Mennonites settled in 10 villages. At Amtrak. Economic prosperity followed right behind. These people started out with money. From the colony, Klaus Epp Jr. led a group of immigrants further east to present-day Turkmenistan to await the return of Christ in 1889. And there's a whole book on that story called The Great Trek. Has anybody ever read that story? It's quite a story. Okay. It's a head shaker. Okay, we won't go any further with that. A few years later, in 1859, Klaus Epp led other families east to the Alexandertal area. And by 1870, 100 families had settled in 10 villages on the broad plains of Samara. Now, Alt-Samara was the last settlement from Prussia, although individual immigrants came later, up through 1880. And interestingly, some Swiss Mennonites of our background, who had earlier moved to Volhynia, became a part of this larger picture. Okay, now, stepping back from all that, industries that support agriculture developed. The Cortiza industrial firm Lepp & Wallman was producing, get this, 50,000 grain swathers by 1900. 8 years later, 151 industrial firms were located in the single town of Cortiza. The original poverty had ended, and these people were blossoming. Can you imagine 150 industrial firms in one town? By this time, Mennonites were serving all of Russia, providing 6% of the agricultural equipment for the entire nation. So the question rises, at what price did the Mennonites acquire their wealth? Well, when the Mennonites came to Russia, they had no experience in self-government. Previously, they had been tolerated by governments who grudgingly gave them space in return for the tax money they provided. But what should they do when the Russian government told them to govern themselves? They could govern themselves however they want to, but they didn't know how. They had no experience. All right, now listen to this. This is hard to believe. But the two original scouts from Prussia, a man by the name of Barsch and another man by the name of Hoppner, became the first political leaders. I mean, obviously, if they came down to search the land, that kind of qualified them. But they were soon deposed, charged, and jailed by the church leadership, because they didn't like what they were doing. They're supposed to be separation of church and state, but already at the beginning, they were losing this thing for a penny. Hearst Gourlach wrote, "In the beginning, it seemed very strange to the individual that one brother should be placed above another brother. But if you're going to run things as a government, somebody has to charge and collect tax. Somebody has to build and maintain the roads. Somebody has to apply fire and insurance regulations. Somebody has to build schools and provide teachers. Somebody has to build the hospitals and get doctors and nurses. Somebody has to take care of the poor. Somebody has to keep order. Somebody has to punish offenders. So how are they going to do that? Well, the only way they could do that is use their own people to do that. And they did. Now, looking at it from another angle, the Russian government had stipulated that a Mennonite family could own 175 acres in one farm, which could not be subdivided. Thus, each Mennonite farm owner would have one vote. The voters in each village would vote for a mayor and his assistants, as well as a colony administrator who would work with Russian officials. Note that the owner needed to be a Mennonite because the Tsar had granted the land only to Mennonites. Thus, to own land, one needed to be a member of the Mennonite church. Now, do you see red flags running? Do people need to repent and become a child of God to be a part of the church? Well, you're supposed to, but if you really want to get along financially, you need to be a member so you could. Well, that invited all kinds of things into the church. Nobody need really be converted. All you need to do is just go through the forms of baptism and membership. And then you could own land. Well, who wouldn't do that? And so these people are stepping down almost immediately once they get there. They're compromising their principles. But the reason they're compromising their principles is because they need to make it economically. Okay, now let me go backwards and talk to you some more about Johann Kornes, because Johann played a huge role. This man, with his parents, came to Malaysia in 1804 while the colony was still in its earliest days. His father owned the typical 175 acres, and his father was the community doctor. But Johann was noted early for his diligence, intelligence, and sense of responsibility. When he married, he quickly became a successful farmer in his own right. It seemed whatever he set out to do prospered. When he was 41, he established an experimental farming station where he raised purebred horses and cattle and sheep. He imported the best animals from all over Europe, including fine Merino sheep from Spain. By 1847, he owned 500 horses, 8,000 sheep, and 200 head of cattle, and also cultivated 25,000 acres of land. He operated a tree nursery from which he sold trees to fellow Mennonites. Remember, the native steppes were treeless. He knew that if you're going to have a successful area, you need to have a bunch of trees. And so he developed nurseries to provide trees for these people. By the end of his life, he had provided 5 million trees, many of them fruit trees. He also introduced the potato to Russia. He promoted irrigation because the steppes were semi-arid. He also promoted crop rotation. And the Russian officials who are watching were impressed. When Kornes was only 28 years old, the Tsar appointed him chairman of the Agricultural Society with authority to regulate farming in all the German settlements. Now, I'd like to ask, how would you older men, I don't know how old you are, Dan, how old are you? 50. Would you like to have a young whippersnapper, 28 years, telling you how to do your business? That's the way it was. That's the way it was. Now, he was supposed to regulate farming in all the German settlements, Mennonite and non-Mennonite, German, Lutheran, and German Catholic as well. Since the Tsar appointed this man to his post and not the church, he had almost unlimited powers. Now, how do you think the church leaders were feeling like this, about this? They feel very threatened by this man. In fact, they resented his influence. They thought he was promoting economic growth at the expense of church concerns. Some leaders thought he was working too closely with non-Mennonites. And believe it or not, he was working too closely with the non-Christian Nogai, which is like the American Indians. He was not being a good Mennonite that only stuck with Mennonites. And so when the leaders opposed him, he threatened to have them exiled from the colony. Another complication in the Mennonite Commonwealth. Cornelius somehow dismissed all this stuff and just went right on. He set out to improve the Mennonite education system. At the time when he got started, the Mennonite education system was learning to the tune of the hickory stick. Remember that method? Lots of hitting with a stick, make him learn. You've read about that stuff. That's the way American education used to be too. Well, he studied the latest European educational theories and published rules on how to teach. This guy did not just stick with farms. He had the general community in mind, and he saw that education really needed to improve. And so, he didn't just read about it. He was a go-to-er, a go-getter. He's going to do something. So he introduced new textbooks, new programs of study, as well as bringing in trained and licensed teachers. He established schools for girls. He established a high school and a teacher training institute, which became the model for other high schools and teacher training institutions. In turn, the developing Mennonite educational system became a model for all of Russia. He became so good at his educational institution that the neighbors copied him. This man was leading in agricultural and educational pursuits in all the interests of his own people. And so, as a result, Mennonite teachers began to teach in non-Mennonite schools. And teachers quickly became influential in colony life. Educated men began to replace farmer preachers in the pulpit and in other community posts. And by 1900, Mennonite young people began to attend Russian and European universities to prepare for their professions. They're really up at the top. This all happened in the space of 100 years. But his critics did not like all this. His critics saw him as a proud, stubborn, and determined man that's going to destroy the Mennonite way of life in Russia. When he declined other official positions, the government wanted him to do all kinds of stuff because he was so capable. But this is what he says. Quote, "I am nothing but a Mennonite farmer who at my baptism promised not to govern or carry arms in accordance with my Christian faith." End of story. He would not take a government position other than what he already had. But Russia was so impressed with this man, the Tsar Alexander I came to visit with him at his house. And Tsar Nicholas I received him at the Tsar's house as a special guest. When this man died at an early death at age 59, I'm 63, he died younger than what I am. Mennonites, now get this next one, Jews, Russians, Moluccans, and the American, the no guy, like the Indians, followed his body to the cemetery. The marble shaft that they put at his grave was broken off at the top, symbolizing his unfinished life. Now, Johann Korney's life story symbolizes the larger Mennonite story in Russia. How? Listen, number one, the Mennonites came as the persecuted people from Prussia. Russia welcomed them, giving them a home. In return, the Mennonites loved the Tsar, even singing his praises. And number two, many Mennonites became quite wealthy in Russia. Some of them believed that their prosperity was a sign of a godly life and that God was blessing their diligence and industry. Their prosperity had no end. Life was like one continuous soft summer evening. Number three, many Mennonites developed an attitude of superiority over their non-Mennonite neighbors. They considered the neighboring Lutherans and Catholics as a notch lower than themselves socially, culturally, and religiously. Their non-Mennonite hired hands were definitely inferior to themselves. Number four, to be married or hold office in a colony, a person needed to be a Mennonite church member. Thus, being a church member often seemed unconnected with being a Christian. As a result, Mennonite morals sank into the mud. Some Mennonites believe that farming and godliness go together. What was to be done when Mennonites multiplied, doubling in number every 25 years, similar to what's happening with the Amish people today? Farms could not be subdivided, and when all available land was purchased, what was to be done? Remember, only land voters had a vote. So pretty soon, a large number of Mennonites had no land and thus no vote. By 1860, two-thirds of the Mennonites in the original two colonies had no votes. Bad situation. Thus, the colonies had a landholding class, including ministers, and powerless, landless class at the bottom. Now, when you have the haves and you have the have-nots, that doesn't last very long. Something has to be done. Johann Cornes maintained that a person did not need to be a farmer to be a Christian. So he decided, you know what? We can't all have farms. So he proposed that we ought to get involved in manufacturing to provide employment for young people. But the manufacturing business could not keep pace with a mushrooming population. When the landowning leaders refused to deal with the landless problem, the landless people at the bottom took their issue directly to the Russian government. At this point, the Russian government allowed subdivision of the 175-acre farms. First time. They also allowed their own lands to be sold to landless buyers and permitted Russian nobles to sell land so that daughter colonies could be created. In the 1870s, when one-third of all the Russian Mennonites, 18,000 of them, left Russia for the United States and Canada, the land situation was temporarily relieved because 18,000 people left. And now there's some farms. But the damage had been done. The Mennonite top, the Mennonite elite, were willing to abuse the people at the bottom, their own people. And so one could really legitimately raise, where was the Christian ethic of love for neighbor in all this? And the question can really be answered by saying, it was basically missing. Something of the basic, fundamental Christian virtue of love was missing. And furthermore, morals were missing. So when you have situations like this, something has to be done even religiously. Klaus Reimer of the Moloshna Colony provided leadership for the first renewal movement in 1812. Now get that. They only got there in 1803. 9 years later, the first renewal movement was underway, and it became known as the Kleine Gemeinde. In 1870, which is about 58 years later, the entire Kleine Gemeinde group moved to North America. How many of you read the book Crossing the Distance? The rest of you need to read that book. This is the story of these people. Okay, in 1860, before this group moved to America, a larger renewal movement, now known as the Mennonite Brethren, formed. And that's these people. The traditional Mennonites did all they could to discredit this new group. The Mennonite Brethren teachers lost their positions. The Mennonite Brethren businesses were boycotted. Some Mennonite Brethren men were jailed and beaten by other Mennonite villagers. The traditional Mennonites went to the Russian authorities to blackmail them. But instead, the Russian government recognized them as a legitimate group, a Mennonite group. And that just devastated the other people. We are the Mennonites. These new Mennonites, these Mennonite brethren, they're not true Mennonites. The government basically said, shut up, they are. For years, hard feelings lingered. The feelings were made worse when the Mennonite brethren began to include non-Mennonite background people in their church membership. All the while, the Russian government was noting how these non-resistant Mennonites were not very non-resistant with their own people. At one meeting, officials told the Mennonites, quote, "We have rooms full of files concerning quarrels and fights within your settlements." Did you know that the government always watches us? We are watched. Is that okay? Sure it is. We have we're every bit as responsible to obey the law as anybody else. And I found out since I moved to Northern Indiana, some people up there say, when it comes to the law, well, we're Amish, like we're above the law. That is a disastrous attitude to have. And so the question was raised, why should the Russian government grant them exemption from military service when the Mennonites pled for the extension of their long-held non-military privileges? If Mennonites could fight with themselves so well, why should the government exempt them from fighting in wars? My brother was a teacher one time, and he had a non-Mennonite background person as one of his patrons. And he told my brother one time, he says, "You know, you Mennonites can fight quite well." Not very complimentary. But with the Kleine Gemeinde and the Mennonite Brethren, spiritual renewal had come to stay. The Mennonite Brethren renewal movement not only improved the spiritual quality of their own movement, but it eventually improved the quality of spiritual life among the people from which they had separated. They were like salt. They were preserving influence, not just for themselves, but for their neighbors. I hope you folks can be that here in this community as well. The Mennonite Brethren movement was barely off the ground in 1860 when terrible news came from Tsar Alexander II. The Mennonite privileges, granted many years before, the privileges that were to last forever, turned out not to be forever. The privileges would come to an end. The Russian government would no longer grant military exemption. Furthermore, the Russian language needed to be taught in the schools. Instead of having all these islands of foreigners in Russia, everything needs to be Russian. And one of the ways you get people to be Russian is to teach the Russian language. Teach Russian history. Teach Russian geography and so on. We've got to stop being German and we're going to have to start being Russian. It was terrible that after all these years, the Mennonites still did not know how to speak the Russian language. The Russian Minister of War exclaimed, "You have been in Russia for 70 years and still can't speak Russian, and that's a sin." The Mennonites knew of only one solution, the solution of their history, and that's move. Where? Yes?
You said that came in 1860?
The announcement came in 1871, I think. They were given 10 years to get out.
Or to acclimate.
Or to become Russian. You got 10 years. And so, in their shock, they decided, well, there's only one option, to move. But when the Russian government heard they were about to lose their entire group of exemplary Mennonite farmers, they said, "Oh, okay, well, how about if we make this concession and that concession and another concession?" And whenever the Mennonites heard this, they said, "Okay, well, the government is going to make some concessions, so most of us are going to stay." One of the concessions was that the government would allow the Mennonites to serve a 4-year term of alternate service in forestry work. But some Mennonites had in their minds, this is never going to work. If Russia came up with this idea now, they're probably going to keep pushing it. And so they immediately began to make plans to emigrate to America. 2/3 of them eventually decided to stay. 1/3 come to America. And that 1/3 was 18,000 Russians, Mennonites. 8,000 settled in Manitoba, Canada. 10,000 came to the United States, including the Hutterites. the people who left and came to both of those places were more of the conservative Russian Mennonites. But you can't say it totally, because Russian Mennonites, smart ones, knew that there's economic opportunities in America. And so the people who could see business possibilities also came. In conclusion, by 1900, those who remained in Russia were gently chiding those who left. After those people left, it's like the economy in Russia just opened up into the golden era, and they prospered like they hadn't been before. And so they're saying to the poor people who left in 1874, why in the world did you leave? You have it so good here. Why go to America? Start all over again. Quote, see how we're prospering here? You have made unnecessary trouble for yourselves by leaving and starting over in a strange, distant land. We still have our religious freedom after all. We have good education, good music, good books, good farms, good businesses, and an improved religious community. Everything is better now than it used to be. And they were correct. The social, economic, and religious life of the Russian Mennonites were stronger than ever. But 17 years later, the Mennonite world exploded with the Bolshevik Revolution. And the very land that they live in, Kortitsa and Molochna, were the center of battles between the Bolshevik army. The Bolshevik army would come this way against the White Army. And then the White Army would push them back. And as armies go back and forth across the land, what do they do to the farms? They need to eat. So they kill their cows, kill their chickens, kill their pigs, steal their horses, and come in and kill the people in the houses. On top of that, there were bandits who were running around. And these were even worse than the armies. Just coming in. And the stuff that happened at this period of time is just about unthinkable. If you want to read an awful book, it's called The Russian Dance of Death, that chronicles what this time period was like. Here, this picture says, roving anarchist bands laid waste to many villages and murdered hundreds of Mennonites. In the above photo, five members of a Thiessen family murdered in their home, January 1918, are laid out for a funeral service. That's just one picture. And there's a whole story there. And once the Bolshevik Revolution ended and it got back to some stability, it wasn't long after that, there was a famine in the land. And that's when MCC stepped in to save people from starvation. After that, Joseph Stalin came to power. And at that point said, nobody may leave. By this time, people tried to get out of Russia. Too late. Couldn't get out. But in the 20s, there was a little opening for people to get out, and some of them went. But once the curtain went down in 1929, they were trapped there, and they could not get out. And then World War II came along. And believe it or not, the Nazi armies came right across their lands again. But the Russians said, okay, these are German people. We may not let them meet their German friends coming through. So they sent all the Russian Mennonite men east. Or killed them or something. Get them out of there. And then they went through. Then at least the men were gone. But when the Russians began to beat the Germans and they had a retreat, when they came back through, many of the women and children went back with the Nazi armies toward Germany. And they thought, we're finally going to get out. Only to be crushed. Because when they got to the borders, they would not let them go. I think two-thirds of them just were forced to go back into their lands. Without their men, tremendous death, hardship, destruction, murder, loss. It seemed like once it started in 1917, it's one continuous story of judgment after judgment after judgment after judgment, so that I think I shared with you last night, by 1940, 40, half of all Mennonite men were killed. Do you know what qualified you to be killed in Stalin's Russia? If you were a business owner. You were called a kulak. And you were liable to be shot. And many Mennonite people sat in their houses at night wondering if the Black Raven would show up. The Black Raven was a group of people. You never knew when they're going to come. And every Mennonite man prepared himself and his family for the night when they would show up. They would come knock at the door and take the man, and that's it. The family never saw him again. Man after man after man after man. And so it has come to a bitter end. And I heard last night that some Mennonites, Umsiedler, is in Germany now, are beginning to think that they want to go back and replant themselves in this land once again. And I shake my head and I wonder, why are they thinking that? And I need to call. Somebody gave me a phone number to call and ask why they're doing that. I haven't done that yet. It's like these people had it so good for so long in Russia, they could hardly give up their dream, even after all the judgments that they've experienced. And so I think we're just going to have to end it with that. Maybe you have some questions that you'd like to ask. Yes. Sometimes. And sometimes they took them away. Nobody knows what happened to them. Do you know that there are the records, the archives of the Russian government have recently become available? I was visiting my son in California. He lives near Fresno. And in Fresno, there's a Mennonite Brethren College. And we went in there to do some research. And we met a lady in there who was working on the computer. And her husband and her were trying to use the archives to see what they were unsealed in Russia, and they're trying to find out the stories of all these people who disappeared, you know, getting documentation on them, because nobody could find out. And so they're feverishly trying to find what they can now. And she said, the curtain is going down again. So it seemed like there was a time of freedom in Russia. But once again, if you're reading the news, you'll notice that things are happening again in Russia. And I can't understand why some of these people want to move back there. Yes?
So how many Mennonites are left in Russia?
Very few. Almost all of them are out of Russia. There are no people there. But their buildings are there. Their graveyards are there. Their church houses are there, as I shared the other night, turned into granaries and theaters and all that kind of stuff. It's there, but the people aren't. Yes?
You said that those that left Russia come to North America were the more religious and the business and so forth. Are those that that are then, has the religious of those people in America prospered, or where are they today?
Very good question. Okay, I wish I was better qualified to answer this, but I'm going to make a statement here, and I'm not God on this. Okay, Cornelius Jansen, when he found out that all these people need to leave Russia, got in contact with John F. Funk over here at Goshen. And John F. Funk became the agent, I guess you could say, in this country to help these people find their way over here. Okay, so when many of these people actually started to come, in some ways, they had a higher spiritual level than some of our people here in this country did. Okay? But when they came here, their culture was so different from our culture. They tried to go to church together. They tried to work together, but there was always a problem. Now, listen real carefully here. That was our people who had some standards and some ways of doing things. But by this time, there was such a group called General Conference Mennonites, which are we call liberal Mennonites. And when they heard about these people, especially when they came to the Midwest, to Kansas and Nebraska and so on, said, you know, come as you are. You don't have to really fit into our mold. We'll just take you as you are. And they said, oh, so we so much appreciate that. And they went in and promptly lost everything that they had. Except for the Holdeman people. And that's a story all of its own. But when we think of those Russian Mennonites today, they have pretty well lost everything. It's such a sad story. Such a sad story. It seems like they lost if they stayed in Russia, and eventually they lost if they came to America. But to this day, they are still wealthy. If you go to California, they are the leaders in the raisin industry. They are in the fruit in California. There's I don't know how many Mennonites are there. One time we visited in Vancouver, Canada. There are 23 Mennonite churches in Vancouver, and we're not talking about little chapels. We're talking about big, wealthy, multi-million-dollar churches. They are still the wealthy of the land in this country. So they have never lost their ability to make money and become wealthy. But they have lost some other things.
It's been true that Central California was a desert until the Mennonites came there and made it a fruit-growing, nut-growing.
Well, they were at least pioneers and leaders in it. I don't think they were the very first that were there, but when they saw an opportunity, they went in there and made it bloom. His son lives out there, so he knows what he's talking about. Okay, there's another hand someplace. Yes.
Brother Chester, you may have covered this in some of your previous lectures, so forgive me if I'm going to be asking you to cover ground again, but could you comment on, wasn't there a small minority of these Russian Mennonites that chose to set aside their non-resistance, formed some renegade defensive bands?
Yes.
If you could talk about that and then what the consequences were for the communities as a whole.
Very good question. When this story was unfolding, when the bandits were running through these villages, killing all these people, some Mennonites said, look, this is just stupid for us to sit by and be non-resistant and let this happen. We ought to at least get some guns and help defend our people. And the Germans were very much ready to help them with their guns. And so they did take up arms, and they did do some defending, and they actually did hold off some of these bandits for a while. For a while. But once they were overpowered, it seems like they were treated worse because they had taken up arms than if they had never taken up arms at all. Anything else? There are books to be read on this. I mean, this is not just a story in a corner. Some of these people are still, to this very day, trying to find their relatives. I have a book at home called Red Quarter Moon, where people in this country or Canada, in the days after communism fell, have gone back to Russia to find their relatives, to see if they're still alive. Some of them got out. Some of them were lost in the shuffle. Some went to Paraguay. Some went to Uruguay, Argentina. It's just like, where are my family? Trying to find and connect to family. Anything else? Yes.
Did you say that the Hutterites were not called Hutterites in Russia or in Prussia until they moved to the United States?
They lived in a community called Hutterthal. And they were ethnic Hutterites. But the Hutterite story is a story completely apart. They, in their desperation to stay alive, actually, Johann Kornes helped preserve them by bringing them in close to and including them with the general area there near Molochna. Okay, but they at that point they were not what we would call Hutterites. They were ethnic Hutterites. They brought the Hutterite ideas with them, but they had so much persecution they never could even establish themselves as a Bruderhof. If only after they came to South Dakota that they actually did that. Anything else? Yes. Well, there's the general books. If you'd like to read the general story, like Smith's Story of the Mennonites or Introduction to Mennonite History, these give you the overview of the story. But then there's specific stories like the Russian Dance of Death, which tells this terrible story. I didn't bring a bunch of those books along, but they exist. Brother Allen just got a bunch. He just went through... another general book is called Through Fire and Water. That gives a story of both the Swiss German and the Russian side of things. I found a book called Journey of Faith in a Hostile World, which is the story of a boy who was 14 when his family went on a trek with Klaus Epp to Turkestan. And his story and how they survived and the things that happen, it just amazes me. It's like almost any one of these stories is like, how in the world did this happen? If you want to see a particular list of books, come talk to me personally and I'll see if I can help you with some. I don't know exactly what your interests are, which part of the story you want, but my guess is that most people need to start with the overview first, so you get a big picture of what you want to look into further. But then there are specific books that you can use to look at the particulars. Okay, anything else? Yes.
Very disheartening, but just kind of wondering about, I know a lot of us here have different backgrounds, but where does this put us today?
Is life for us one long, continuous summer evening? I'm not a prophet, I'm not God, but I'm saying that we better do our homework about some of the stuff we were talking about this morning over here. We do not know the future, and it looks a little dark. We better do our homework, but we cannot manage God and what's going to happen. All we need to do is be fortified in our faith and then surrender to God as He unfolds whatever's going to be. And I hate to tell you things like this, but I don't think our children have a very bright future. But that's okay. Do you realize that the freedoms we have been abnormal for Christian people? And we have, for the last 50 years, we'll say, considered the abnormal to be the norm. And it's not. And many of us expect life to be one continuous soft summer evening. And that's not been the story of God's people, ever. All right, well, you have been a very attentive audience. And your hearts, I can tell your hearts are here, and your hearts are concerned, and your hearts want to follow Christ. I bless you in that. And all I can say is, do all that you can that Christ is asking you to do. Just be as faithful as He wants you to be and let Him direct you however He will into the future. It's like once we have our hand in His, it's okay, whatever comes. And I sense that you've already honestly tried to put your hands in God's hand, and I bless you in that. I want to thank you for your hospitality and taking good care of me. I think I've learned to make some new friends. I don't know all of you yet, but I appreciate it. Being here and to learn to know some of you and fellowship together. So thank you very much.